Discover all the latest shows, sessions and mixes on the BBC Sounds app.
Six Music.
Right now. It's the first time with Thomas Bangalter.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved artists around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. And today's show is a special one. From their formation in 1993 until they announced their split in 2021, Daft Punk hardly ever gave interviews. The duo of Thomas Bangalter and Guy Manuel de Om Cristo rarely spoke to the media. Aside from a tiny handful of conversations, the pair remained silent and hidden under their helmets as the robots. This didn't stop them becoming one of the best and biggest acts in the world, creating four classic albums that brought together house, techno, pop, funk, hip-hop, R&B and rock, both hard, soft and prog, and disco. They staged a groundbreaking 2007 tour that remains the benchmark for live electronic music shows, created a feature film, Electroma, and soundtracked another, Tron Legacy, collaborated with some of the greatest artists ever and remain one of the most influential and mysterious groups of all time. However, last year, Thomas Bangalter released the first solo work from either member. This was Mythologies, an entirely orchestral classical album composed to accompany a 2022 ballet of the same name. And Thomas decided to speak to the first time. So I'm very pleased to welcome to the first time today, Thomas Bangalter. In this show, we cover Thomas's earliest musical influences, his passion for horror movies, and the start of Daft Punk and the psychology of those helmets. We also talk about the band's cult film, Electroma, his huge love for Paul Williams, his approach to working on Mythologies, and why Daft Punk ended. But I started by asking Thomas, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music as a child?
It's hard to remember because my father is a composer and producer, and my mother was a dancer, so I think I was pretty much surrounded by a lot of music. But my first strong memory of music and film is pretty much the same one. My father was putting me in the morning in front of this old Betamax VCR that we had. And I was just like watching Modern Times on repeat. So I think it was like the first true shock of discovering Chaplin's world character and his music as well, which hold a very dear place for me.
Signora Pilassina, voulez-vous le taxi mitre? Le junteur sous la cita. Tula 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 wa.
What was your father's record collection like? Was there a lot of classical, a lot of pop, a lot of... Was it a real mix?
I remember... I don't know. I mean, I almost feel like Songs in the Key of Life was on the turntable for all my childhood at the same time, you know? So it's very strange to think whether it was a really big collection or whether it was just a glimpse of a few landmark record that shaped my childhood like that.
Good morning or evening, friends. Here's your friendly announcer. I have serious news to pass on to everybody. What I'm about to say could mean the world's disaster. Could change your joy and laughter to tears and pain. It's that love in need of love today. Don't delay, send yours in.
What was the first record you owned?
The first record I owned, I don't know, I think it might be a VHS cassette of like the Thriller music video. There was this thing, the making of Thriller.
Yes, I remember.
You know, which was like, so you had like the video, and then there was this documentary about the...
John Landis.
The John Landis shoot. And then there was like, as a bonus, there was the Motown 25th anniversary with the moonwalk sequence.
I remember.
So... yes, I think Thriller as was. I mean, I was seven when it came out. That was my big my second big or third, I don't know, shock. But as discovering this universe and this music and at the same time, I started really to love horror films and scary movies. I don't know, maybe I saw Jaws when I was like 8 or 9 years old and I was super proud about it. And then it kept on with Guy Mann, my partner from Daft Punk. We watched the Texas Chainsaw Massacre when we were 12, and I was convinced the tape was cursed. So after we went back right away to the video store to give it. And I was like, there's no way I can sleep tonight with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre tape in my household, you know.
Because, yeah, we're kind of the same generation. And there was a whole era. I remember being like 11 or 12 and watching Death Race 2000.
Yeah.
Because like, you could just go to the store and rent
it. Yes, yes.
And that doesn't happen anymore.
I think the video store era is probably the most mystical memories I have, especially when the tracking was bad on the on the machine, and there was this really mystical experience of watching these worn out videotapes and discovering something hidden at with this lo-fi quality that was actually making the movies now, I think, much more scary than they are.
Yeah.
I think now when you watch the 4K restoration of some of these movies, they don't seem as scary as like the VHS. It's probably like the Ring effect, you know, the movie The Ring, when you have like this video. The VHS is just creepy format, but it's also a very mystifying one. So that VHS tape was something I remember as a strong memory.
Yeah. First concert that you went to that really made a big impact on you?
The big memory I had, it's probably not the first, but I was 10 years old, was the Bruce Springsteen Born in the USA tour in Paris, in La Courneuve, and just outside of Paris, which was, I don't know, like maybe 100,000 people. And that was amazing for me. I mean, speaking of confidence, where you're going to that concert, and then he starts the concert with that song. You know, and so
you opened with it.
You opened with it.
Wow!
And
that's cool.
I've never felt something like that, where that moment of just waiting and going, and then it's the Born in the USA tour. You went. You know, it probably might be the second to last song,
yeah,
and it's the first one
of
the tour. That was an amazing memory. That's I think unsurpassed in that idea, because I don't recall having seeing another experience like that, where you have that boldness of doing that.
Yeah. It also releases. It's like, okay, we've done that now.
So yes.
Now we can just...
Yes.
You're not being held to ransom.
Exactly. No. It's the management of hits in a set list is a tough thing, I imagine.
Yeah. What was your first performance? When did you first perform in front of an audience?
Wow. Yes. As Daft Punk, it was in 1994, 95, in a bar / club in Marseille, called the Trolley Bus, which was on the Vieux Port. I think it's maybe there still, on the Vieux Port, which is the harbor in Marseille, on the left side of the docks. And it's this very long, like a narrow corridor that's turned into a club.
Really
and,
good for the sound, yeah.
Really good for the sound, and we were terrified, but and Guy Mann was so terrified that he spent the entire there was this table with all the machines and the samplers and his synthesizers, that he spent like almost half of the show like hidden under the table, and it was just like then me with him, but him like adjusting the buttons and the machines from below like that. And that was the first one with electronic music. The one before, though, I remember now, we had this band called Darlin, mm-hmm. with Laurent Brankovitz from Phoenix as well, and we did this concert maybe about a couple of years before of our band in Versailles. No, it was in the suburbs. I don't remember where it was. And same thing. Guy Mann was like turning the back, facing the amps, the guitar amps, and then showing his back to the audience. I didn't have a long career as a rock band, so there was like a couple of shows, and then we called it quits.
And what was the first Daft Punk release? Was it New Wave?
Yes, the first Daft Punk, yes, was New Wave, Alive. Yeah. Alive, I mean, yeah, it was kind of New Wave, but Alive is kind of the track that made it until today, I imagine, you know, ended up on being on Homework.
What do you remember about recording that? Because the myth is that Homework was all literally in your bedroom, is that?
It's not a myth, it's true. Homework and Discovery were done in the bedroom, I mean, in the same flat that I was watching Modern Times, and that we had Songs in the Key of Life constantly on the turntable. So, so this small bedroom, my parents had given me, I think, a small boombox for my 11th birthday, a JVC boombox with little graphic equalizer.
Yeah, graphic equalizers. No one has graphic equalizers anymore.
It's true. Now they're virtual graphic equalizers. And I kept this thing, and eventually that's just one day when we plugged a few keyboard and samplers. I found back that boombox, and I put it on the stack of machines, and that little boombox is what we mixed both and recorded both Homework and Discovery on, and Human After All as well. I think that was the magic one.
Alive by Daft Punk, and you're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest from Daft Punk, Thomas Bangalter. More after this.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
6 Music's Artist Collection, where we anthologise an artist. This time, we're celebrating one of the biggest rock bands of the 90s, Oasis, showcasing their best live performances. Iconic interviews.
The geek walked up to me and he said, "What are your band called?" And I said, "Oasis." He said, "Do you want a record deal?" So he said, "Yeah, why not?"
Plus, curated playlists and highlights from the BBC archives. 6 Music's Artist Collection, Oasis. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
6 Music.
One of your other big musical loves is Jacques Lussier. Can you tell me when you first fell in love with his work?
Jacques Lussier, I mean, it's really this connection that's very dear for me with Bach. So Jacques Lussier being this amazing pianist and jazz pianist who had the studio in France that Brad Pitt actually just bought back right now in the south of France. So Playback is this a record that he put out with the jazz trio where he plays some Bach music in a jazz trio outfit.
Right.
And the Prelude in C major, which is Prelude number 1, which is really probably my first memory of classical music. My grandmother was playing it all the time when I was a kid, and that record I started really to listen to when I was a teenager, and it is probably the record that I've listened up to that day the most. That's, I think, really my Desert Island record by far, this one. It has calmed me down in every scenario, I don't usually have a drink when I come back after home after days of work, but this listening to this track is making me probably the same effect, you know.
Ask you about with Daft Punk, you start wearing the helmets and it starts becoming this separation. And I just thought, obviously, it's a really clever thing to do because you just concentrate on the music. Did you have to do that? Because it got really big.
Oh, it got completely out of proportions. Wearing some masks and having fun with the white label, mm-hmm. Anonymous quality of the rave scene or the underground scene, like it was, you know, there was this collective in Detroit called Underground Resistance, which we really liked, and there was just a general aspect of just playing those records, listening to music you really didn't know sometimes what the name of the song was or the track, so it felt it was totally natural and part of it, and after homework it's true that our manager at the time, Pedro Winter, usually jokes about the fact that we would go a little bit before photo shoots those shops where they sold like tricks and party masks and things, and just like, you know, get random things and just have fun with hiding with plastic mask or clown mask and things like that. And after having done that for like a year or so around the release of Homework, I really remembered thinking, well, it'd be fun to just have some special effects guys from Hollywood, you know, do these personas and robotic personas, like if they were part of the Cantina scene in Star Wars or something like that, you know. And but it was a weird idea, and neither me nor Guiman, I think, ever imagined that it would ended up taking such proportions, where it just seemed like a very weird idea to mix again these ideas that you would get from watching sci-fi movie, and then okay, there's been like the kiss makeup or the resident eye, and what could be fun to play around with an imaginary character.
Are they in a warehouse? Is there like is it like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark, where you open a big warehouse?
Pretty much.
And there's hundreds of like much. Different masks and helmets.
You know, it's funny because there's been many different generations, and some are very rusty and rusted, you know. So it's where you feel like, oh, okay, time has passed, you know, like there's really someone that are starting to become like quite deteriorated. But no, it's fun memories. I feel it was fun to start an adventure like this, and to create this narrative, and to blur this line between fiction and reality, because in some way I felt it's almost like directing a film without cameras, you know, where you're creating those personas, and they just exist in the what became after maybe I mean the pop music industry or something like that, but it allowed for a certain playfulness around this, and without imagining that actually the performance act or something would actually last that long. You know, you have an idea like that when you're like 25, you don't say, oh yeah, you know what, we're just gonna like build robot mask and dress up like robots until the day we die or something like that.
Celebrate and dance so free. One more time. You just got have been feeling so free. We're gonna celebrate, celebrate and dance so free. One more time, I've been feeling so free. We're gonna
One More Time by Daft Punk, and you're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest from Daft Punk and now solo artist, Thomas Bangalter. And we'll be back with more from Thomas right after the Six Music News.
Six Music. This is BBC Radio. Six Music.
BBC News at 9:30. I'm Matthew Carter. Donald Trump has appeared before a judge at a courthouse in Washington, D.C. to be formally charged with four counts related to the 2020 presidential election, including conspiracy to defraud the United States. Well, in the past few minutes, he's pleaded not guilty to all four charges. Carl Nasman is at the courthouse for the BBC and says security is tight.
You can see some of the heightened security here. As soon as you arrive outside of the district federal courthouse, there are metal barricades all the way around. Some of the security, though, not as visible. We know that Secret Service are here. They're always in tow. And we're talking about a president or a former president. There's been coordination between local police officials and federal law enforcement as well. So plenty of security being beefed up here.
The Bank of England has signalled that interest rates are unlikely to start coming down anytime soon after they went up for the 14th time in a row. The base rate has risen by a quarter of a percentage point to 5.25%, meaning that borrowing costs are now at their highest level since April 2008. Jemana Salaheen is from the investment management company Vanguard.
Is it the right thing to do? We at Vanguard think yes, it's the right thing to do, because in order to get inflation back to target, you know, we believe that actually a couple of more rate hikes are going to be necessary. Inflation is proving to be sticky around the world, not just in the UK.
Questions have been raised about security at the Prime Minister's home in his Yorkshire constituency after Greenpeace activists managed to get on the roof. They draped the house in black fabric to protest about government plans to issue new licences for oil and gas exploration in the North Sea. Five people have been arrested. Two drug dealers who stabbed to death an aspiring lawyer in North London have been told they'll each serve a minimum of 27 years in jail for his murder. The Old Bailey heard that Sven Badzak and a friend were attacked by a group of six men who mistook them for members of a rival gang in Kilburn in 2021. The Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves has challenged Rishi Sunak to a game of chess. She made the offer on Radio 2 earlier today when Jeremy Vine asked her about the Prime Minister's plans to install 100 chess sets in parks across the country.
I really hope we get one at a park in Leeds West. Armley Park, Stanningley Park, all of them would love to have one of these chess sets. There's not, doesn't sound like there's very many to go around, but also if Rishi Sunak fancies a game of chess, I'm happy to take him on too.
Mr. Sunak is a keen chess player and Ms. Reeves is a junior champion. Downing Street has yet to respond. And the American Super Bowl champion Tom Brady has bought a minority stake in Birmingham City Football Club. He retired from American football after 23 seasons in February. The club said Brady would also work closely with management on marketing and commercial partnership opportunities. And that is Six Music News for tonight.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest, one half of Daft Punk, and now solo artist, Thomas Bangalter. You just heard International Feel by Todd Rundgren, the first song on the soundtrack to Daft Punk's 2006 avant-garde sci-fi film, Electroma, a film without dialogue that tells the story of the two Daft Punk robots attempting to become human, written and directed by the band, but featuring none of their music. What did you learn as a director of that you are bringing to your work now, do you think? Because, was it done in like, it was a short shoot, wasn't it?
10 days. 10 days, 11 days.
That's insane.
For me, I was the cinematographer on it too, so it's true. It was at a time where I stopped making music for about 2 years, and I was really obsessed with cinematography and film cameras and wanted to experiment with it. So it was an interesting experience to take a camera and film these two characters, but with that distance.
Yeah.
And the theme over there that we had come up was already this conflict between humanity and the robots, and the robots wanting to become human, and these ideas about consciousness and emotion and artificial intelligence, and so it felt natural for me and Guiman when we did this experimental film to use other people's music we loved and not do it ourselves, because it was an intimate thing where we were already given a lot, I think, in it. And again, it's unusual, so there's a lot. It's maybe the same thing then with the robot mask and Metz. Is like it's hard to think. People might understand. Is it like a companion? Is it like a marketing thing to sell more records? But our love of all of this approach, it really comes from discovering Andy Warhol at 12 years old, and the Velvet Underground and the Factory, and this idea of pop art as a global thing, where it's just whether it's Femme Fatale or Flesh for Frankenstein or Flesh, or you know, it creates these galaxies or of pop art, and sometimes experimental object, and sometimes mysterious avant-garde things, which was driven by our love of counterculture like that, but also of Michael Jackson and Steven Spielberg and E.T. and pop and the other side of that pop spectrum as well.
I want to be alone. I need to touch each stone. Face the grave that I have grown. I want to be alone. Before all the days are gone, and darker walls are bent and torn, to pass the time of those who mourn, I want to be alone.
Another name on the list. Who should we go to next? Paul Williams?
Paul Williams is one of my hero, I think. Phantom of the Paradise was really the ultimate teenage memory or shock that I had, because it had everything that I liked at the time, which was horror, music, and rock and roll, and glam, and also something like the Phantom of the Opera mythology as well, you know, and Faust as well. So it was like kind of clashing and combining everything. And Brian De Palma did such an amazing job at making a movie that's like a comic book, really. I feel something that is colorful and that is completely disconnected from reality, but somehow from the minute the film starts, you believe everything it tells you. And somehow the amazing idea of using the Faust analogy of selling your soul for the rock and roll world was so on point. And then Paul Williams combines not only the ultimate character as an actor and as a singer and as a composer. I mean, this is. I took this film as like. To me, I have the same relationship to Phantom of Paradise that I have with a song or with music. Usually, the relationship with music, you know, music you're gonna listen like 100 times to your favorite songs, and then a film, you know, your favorite film you're gonna watch like 6 times or 8 times, yeah. And then you just put it aside and just remember that you like this thing, but you don't experience it. When I was 13, I had actually transferred the entire film of Phantom of the Paradise on a cassette. On an audio cassette, and I had a Walkman, and I would be in junior high school in Paris listening to the film with the dialogue, and actually, you know, to just the soundtrack and the audio track with the dialogue of the film, and just so it was like the audio version of it.
I was mad myself last night in the morning light. I could see a change was showing. Like a child who was always poor, reaching out for more, I could feel the hunger growing. And as I lost control, I swore I'd sell my soul for one love who would sing my song and fill this emptiness inside me. One love sing my song,
sing my song.
Lay beside me while we dream a bit of style.
It was the most amazing moment, I think, in my life as a musician to meet Paul and to write song with songs with him and then to record him sing and then to finish that I mean these couple of songs we did together, but especially the one is singing on Touch, which is a song for all these reasons that has a very special place for me, just as that connection of space-time continuum of interacting with your childhood heroes. I mean, the same goes with most of the collaborators on Random Access Memories. But here, it kind of defined so many elements, and each time I come back to his voice, his music, and to the film as well, I discover different connections and hidden messages, which makes me understand some things that I've done or not out of purpose, almost connected to this subliminal experience of having been. Voluntarily brainwashed by that film.
Touch, I remember touch. Pictures came with touch. A painter in my mind. Tell me what you see. A tourist in a dream. A visitor, it seems. A half-forgotten song. Where do I belong? Tell me what you see. I need something more. Kiss, suddenly alive. Happiness arrive. Hunger like a storm. How do I begin? A room within a room. A door behind a door. Touch, where do you lead? I need something more. Tell me what you see. I need something more.
Why did you end Daft Punk?
I think, you know, again, there's a connection between fiction and reality, and everything we did was the different chapters in the story. And a story, by definition, has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
You've thought about that, haven't you?
I started to think about it, but it's true because you know, I mean, it's as if every reasons or every clues in that semi-fictional or semi-autobiographical body of work as a partnership is disseminated inside, you know, and you know, the epilogue that comes after the different chapters contains elements of Electroma, so it kind of like there's an overall trajectory of it, and the question I ask more myself is why we did end it rather than how long could it last for so long, you know. We were very critical, me and Guiman, in the history of rock and roll, of all these bands that eventually you know, fade. Are not fade, but are like kind of start to be disconnected,
yeah,
and age from the start, and we didn't think that we could get away with it either. So the fact of you know, I started when we started, I was 18, and when we ended Daft Punk, I was 46. It's been a significant part of my life, but I'm relieved and happy to look back on it and say, okay, we didn't mess it up too much. And it's a lot of discipline and effort. Same thing with the characters, with everything. So it definitely felt good, you know. But it's a lot like stories or at least like mini sagas. Sometimes there's like a TV show or something that has like a special place in people's heart. And it keeps that place, and it runs for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, sometimes 10 seasons. And there's a moment where it ends. And I think it's actually interesting to have this opportunity to start, to have the middle, and to end it.
Music.
There's a spiritual energy in heavy bass frequencies every Friday this summer from morning until night.
We are raving.
Six Music's Rave Forever.
By the noughties, dance music is on main stages across the world.
Put on our classics and we'll have a little dance, shall we?
This Friday, expect all the songs you love and new discoveries from this decade.
Rave Forever, all day, this Friday.
And listen anywhere on the BBC Sounds app.
Tell me about hearing Mythologies, hearing your score played by an orchestra for the first time.
It's very moving, it's very humbling. It's not as crazy as hearing it by a second orchestra being played for the first time, which I was fortunate, and by a third orchestra, and that's where it's plain crazy, because that's almost where you're like, okay, you know, there was 55 person playing that music, and it was this encounter with a score and with that solitary work that I've worked on for months. And in Bordeaux, we did that. We did this record. And then when we moved back after to the Rouen Opera and then to the Paris Châtelet with different orchestra each time. And whether the differences and the consistencies at the same time in the score made it even crazier for me and more emotional, because you're like, okay, now the difference between those two orchestra is what is the music, mm-hmm. in some sort, you know. So that created something very very special and quite scary too, because you know, you work for a long time, and then the rehearsal time or the recording time or the performance time is really limited, so you just hope that you didn't create something unplayable or terrible.
How has it changed you? What have you learned from doing this hugely ambitious album?
I think it happened at a time where I wanted to keep on questioning my relationship to technology in the way that I've done it in the past, because it's been a continuous exploration of that, you know. And as things got more and more technological or robotic, even the fact that, you know, this was probably a facade, because the main goal with Daft Punk was really to use machines and synthesizers to create the most human emotional connections, and it actually took a lot of time to do. I was questioning the idea of okay, I need a little less of technology in my daily life right now, and I want to experiment to see if, as a composer, as a musician, I could have become one or be one without a synthesizer or without a machine. So I was not sure of that, but I wanted to experiment this. And so it created an opportunity also of stop multitasking for a little bit, because I'm in front of with a small laptop and a notation software, and it's like a blank page, and there's this fixed palette, yet with infinite possibilities of these 55 musicians, and it was for my sanity. I think I thought that it would like be a resting place, and it was in very zen in some sort, but it just became a labyrinth of a chess playing and difficult moves that but it was an interesting intellectual stimulation at the same time. So I don't know yet what I've learned, but I've always loved putting myself in a position where I feel like I don't know a lot, and that the years and decades of experience that I've been through are not refraining me from feeling like a newcomer and a debutant and a novice and wanting to be, still be driven by my curiosity rather than by past accomplishments or experiences.
Final thing, what piece of music should we finish on? What should we play?
Nat King Cole is, we go back to the modern times, Connection, which is the so it's crazy to think that there's a Nat King Cole song written, I mean, composed by Charlie Chaplin. You know, I like this idea in the 20th century. And I also, I mean, I love the melody, and I also, it's an example of I could not see a better fit between the lyrics and the music as well, and how they connect when you really listen and you put in action, I mean, what the singer is telling you to do.
Then that's the last song we'll play. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile, even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by if you smile through your fear and sorrow. Smile and maybe tomorrow you'll see the sun come shining through. For you, light up your face with gladness, hide every trace of sadness. Although a tear may be ever so near, that's the time you must keep on trying. Smile, what's the use of crying? You'll find that life is still worthwhile if you just smile. The time you must keep on trying. Smile, what's the use of crying? You'll find that life is still worthwhile if you just smile.
That was Smile by Nat King Cole, the final choice of my guest here on The First Time today, Thomas Bangalter. There's more episodes of The First Time up on BBC Sounds as we speak, including recent shows with Jenny Lewis, Feist and Damian Lewis, and some of the archive shows up there as well, including my chats with Sinead O'Connor, Tom York, Dave Grohl and Elton John. That is the end of this run of The First Time, but I'll be back with more later on in the year. Until then, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.
Take Six Music with you. Listen live on the BBC Sounds app. This is
BBC Radio
Six Music right now. This is Riley and Co. on BBC Radio Six Music.